for giving me the opportunity to give this talk. I'm going to talk about how flux compactifications can grow lumps. This is based on some recent work, primarily that I did with Alex Dahlin, who is a former postdoc at Berkeley. And it's also related to some work that I did about a year ago with Kurt Hinterbickler, who's in the audience, and as well as Jana Levin. Okay, so to begin with, I'm just gonna start with an overview, the setup. I'm gonna spend the entire talk discussing a particular toy model, which I'll describe in a moment. This toy model has two sets of known solutions. The first are the so-called symmetric solutions, which are well studied and which I'll review. And then the second are a new set of warp solutions, which can be constructed numerically. So I'm gonna spend much of this talk mapping out the physics of these new warped solutions. Then I'm going to discuss and motivate an effective potential description which neatly encapsulates the physics of these warp solutions. And finally, I'm going to discuss some non-perturbative decays that take you from the symmetric solutions to the warp solutions, and also some ideas for future work. So to start out, the toy model. So the toy model is given by the simple higher dimensional action defined in capital D dimensions, which consists of an Einstein-Hilbert term, a flux term, and a bare cosmological constant. So the geometry here consists of a q-dimensional internal manifold, which is wrapped by the flux, which is a q-form flux, as well as p equal to capital D minus q extended dimensions. And in the remainder of the talk, I'm going to restrict to the case p larger than or equal to 3 and q larger than or equal to 2. Okay, so before we start, just some motivations for even spending our time considering this toy model. So first of all, this is often known as the simplest model of stabilized extra dimensions. So the reason for this, which I'll discuss in some more detail soon, is that the flux, which is distributed on the sphere, naturally wants to repel itself. And at the same time, curvature provides an attractive term which wants to keep the sphere bound. So these two effects can interact to form a stable minimum. Second, this is one of a handful of toy models, which is often invoked to gain intuition about the much more complicated string landscape. So in this sense, we take the philosophy of toy models, and the approach is to fully study this simple model and then try to understand if some of the physical implications carry over to the more general cases of interest. And surprisingly, this is actually not completely done. So in another sense, this is just a very nice simple physics problem. It's an extremely simple physical system, which has been around for more than 50 years, and yet which still has some rich and tractable corners of phase space that remain to be understood. Okay, so here is the slide where you should pay attention if you pay attention to only one slide, because I'm gonna tell you the take-home message, the result of our analysis. Essentially, we found that even this simplest model is actually far from simple. There are symmetry-breaking effects where if you start with a symmetrically shaped internal manifold, generically, this manifold will develop lumps, and this can happen either perturbatively or non-perturbatively. So the basic picture that you should have in mind is, say, you start with an internal manifold, which is a sphere, perfectly symmetric. Well, in general, it will either want to roll or tunnel to a solution which is, for example, shaped like what we call a football, shaped like what we call an M&M shape, or in the more general case, just some arbitrary lumpy manifold, which destroys the symmetry. Yes. No. So the idea is, the idea is. Oh, you mean the peanut MMM, okay. All right, for clarification, yes. But it's also, okay, the standard M&M versus the football. Okay, whoops. Okay, so now let's discuss the symmetric solutions and review some of their properties. So recall this is our higher dimensional action. So imagine that we assume a direct product space, then it turns out from the equations of motion that this implies that both components are Einstein spaces. So in particular, we can make a particular choice of some p-dimensional Einstein space, which forms a direct product with a Q-sphere. So this, keep in mind, is what we mean by the symmetric solutions. And this is often also called the Freund-Rubin model. So this space has just the direct product metric written above, where L is the lower dimensional curvature length, and R is the radius of the sphere, which is a constant. The lower dimensional Einstein space has the following effective cosmological constant, just the standard formula for Einstein space. And there is a conserved flux called N, which is just equal to the integral of the Q sphere, the Q form flux over the Q sphere. And in the case of these direct product solutions, this is just proportional to the volume on the Q sphere. So here, N is the flux number, which is quantized, and rho is the flux density. So a lot of the physics of these solutions is neatly contained in this effective potential description, where we treat the sphere as a fixed shape and we allow the radius to vary as a radion field. So when you do this, you work out the equations of motion for this field R, and it lives in this effective potential. So the first term is just some unimportant factor which results from the conversion from D to p-dimensional Planck mass, basically just to get the scalar and Einstein frame. These are the important terms. We have a flux term, which is repulsive and which dominates at small radius. We have a curvature term, which is attractive and dominates in the middle regime. And we have the cosmological constant, which is repulsive and which dominates at large radius. So here's the pictorial representation. And you can see that, as I mentioned earlier, these three different terms can interact to form a stable minimum. This splits into two different cases. The first case is when lambda, the total cosmological constant, is less than or equal to zero. And in this case, there's always only one solution. There's always only one solution, and it sits at negative V effective. In other words, it's an ADS solution. And as you increase the solution, as you increase N, the cosmological constant increases and it pushes out to larger radius. In the case where the cosmological constant is positive, there are now potentially two possible solutions. One, the stable minimum, it can either be ADS or it can be de Sitter. And again, as you increase N, this lifts and pushes out to larger radius. There's a second unstable solution, which is de Sitter. And as you increase N, these two solutions come together. And then at a certain point, some critical value of N, they merge, and then they annihilate. And above this critical value for N, there are actually no solutions, and the effective potential is just monotonically decreasing. So keep this in mind. We'll return to some of these things later. Okay, so the second thing to discuss about the symmetric solutions is their stability. Once you construct solutions, you might want to wonder what happens under small perturbations around the solution. So this is a question that has been addressed extensively in these papers, which I've listed at top. I'm not going to have time to go into all the details of this calculation, but I'm just going to sketch out for you the basic procedure that you would follow, as well as some of the results that will be applicable to this work. So first, you want to start with a metric and flux, which you expand, you separate them into a background piece and a fluctuation. And then the procedure that you need to follow is first, you expand the fluctuations in a complete basis of forms on the internal manifold. And in this expansion, the coefficients will just become the lower dimensional fields. Then you expand the action to quadratic order. you integrate over the internal manifold, and then since in general you may get cross terms, you need to diagonalize to re-express in terms of physical fields, and then from this you can read off the spectrum and from the sign of the mass term, the stability. So in general, when you expand in a complete basis of forms, this separates into a sum of many different components, each of which lie in some part of a direct sum decomposition of a form on an internal space. And each of these different sectors will consequently result in different Kaluza-Klein towers on the lower dimension, in the lower dimensional space. So for the purposes of this talk, I'm just going to restrict to one such sector, the so-called shape mode sector. And this sector, in this sector, we expand in spherical harmonics. Again, the coefficients in this expansion are just the lower dimensional fields. So it turns out that when you do this stability calculation for the direct product case, on a sphere, the only possible instabilities in addition to the ones in the volume direction come from this shape mode sector. Yes?
When you do this, you're always assuming that you're fixing the radii at one of the solutions, right?
No, you're allowing it to perturb around the solution.
No, but the background,
you're fixing the background,
yeah.
And then you're looking at small perturbations around that.
But you're not considering the evolution of these perturbations while the radii is evolving towards its minimum, like on an inflationary background.
No, you're literally just, you fix the background, then you expand in small fluctuations around that.
A static solution, not a dynamical evolution.
Exactly. Yeah.
Good. This just to reiterate, this is the only possibility where potentially instabilities can come in. And in when you do this calculation, it turns out that the instabilities can occur for q larger than or equal to 4, and then there's some parameter space which describes exactly when you get these instabilities. Okay. So what are the resulting p-dimensional shape modes in this sector? Well, you have one which comes from the graviton trace, which essentially this is just a perturbing the shape of the sphere. So perturbing the shape to become slightly lumpy, and the way in which it becomes lumpy corresponds to the analogous spherical harmonic that you're expanding in. So here I've depicted the L equals 2 case, and that is the case where the sphere perturbs to either become slightly M&M-shaped, standard M&M-shaped, or slightly football-shaped. And then the flux perturbation, well, to start out with in the background solution, the flux was distributed uniformly. So the flux perturbation is one where the distribution becomes slightly non-uniform. So for example, either the flux concentrates on the poles or it concentrates in the equator. And then I'm just going to wiggle this so that you can see the distribution. But remember I said you might need to diagonalize. There may be cross terms you may need to diagonalize. And it turns out that in this case, that is true. These fields H and A mix together. So the physical shape mode is actually a linear combination of this shape mode, graviton shape mode, and flux mode. So there are two possible linear combinations, and one of them is the so-called danger mode, because this mode can sometimes have negative mass squared. So this signifies a possible shape mode instability. And it turns out you can work it out, but in the case of this danger mode, the correlation is such that the flux density gets larger where the radius is larger. And the opposite is actually true for the other mode, but we are not going to concern ourselves with that because it's always stable. So here is a representation of this correlation. In the M&M shape, we have the flux concentrating around the equator where the radius is larger. So here, I just wiggle it so you can see. And then for the football, we have the flux concentrated along the poles. Okay, so bear with me. This is a little bit complicated, but I'll try to explain the important points of this diagram. What this diagram represents is the result of the calculation. In other words, the stability. So it turns out that when you work it out, the danger mode has a negative mass squared if and only if this condition that I've written at the bottom of the slide is true. So this diagram is supposed to represent when you don't have instabilities. So to the left, I've just plotted the first part of this equation, rho squared r squared as a function of r squared. And this is just, when you fix lambda, this is just a linear relation with r. So given some fixed value of lambda and fixed value of r, I can continue horizontally to the right side of this plot and read off which of the modes are stable and which are unstable. So let's, as a warm-up, start by considering the total volume case, which we already reviewed when we discussed the total volume direction effective potential. This is given by the green lines. So if you recall, we said that when lambda was less than or equal to zero, which is this top region, there was only a single solution, and it was always stable, and it was always ADS. Well, that's consistent with this region of the plot. However, when lambda was positive, there were two possibilities. There could either be an ADS or a de Sitter solution, and when the solution was ADS, it was always stable, and when the solution was de Sitter, then it was sometimes stable and sometimes unstable. So this is all consistent with the picture we had before. Now let's move on to some of the shape mode instabilities. Well, the first case to consider is the case where L is equal to Q minus 1. So if you stare at this equation for a little bit, you see that that exactly saturates the bound for lambda equals 0. So indeed, if you continue horizontally from lambda equals 0, you see that for the L equals Q minus 1 mode, this is exactly saturated. It's exactly the boundary between developing negative mass squared and positive mass squared. And for all the lower L modes, you actually have an instability, whereas for all the higher modes, you have stability, which is a little bit counterintuitive, but that's the result. And greater than or equal to 2. Yeah.
I looked at these papers. All these in the negative lambda case are still above the BF bound. Is that correct?
In the negative lambda case, the only case where you can have instabilities is when lambda is positive.
M squared being negative in ADS isn't necessarily an instability.
So you have to compare with the BF bound, exactly, instead of comparing to just M squared equals 0. Right, so there's a kind of a distinction between comparing with the BF bound and comparing with M squared equals 0. It turns out that for the purposes of this talk, what we'll really care about is M squared equals 0, as I'll explain a little bit later. But you're right that for the stability, you technically need to compare not with M squared equals 0, but with the BF bound in ADS.
Okay, keep
going. Yes.
It's still initial odds.
Okay, yeah, sounds good.
So you're saying basically there is an instability, a potential instability when the cosmological constant is positive, right?
Yes.
And for a sphere, you have just basically a static patch of the de Sitter, right? I mean, there is no dynamic. I guess my question is, do we really have to worry about instability in de Sitter when our vacuum is de Sitter? Do we really have to worry that we have modes? I mean, again, this is sort of coming back to maybe it's a comment when
you
have a dynamical situation and you'll just have inflation, but you already had inflation to begin with, right? So if the vacuum is de Sitter, it's...
So, I mean, in the case of de Sitter, when the lower dimensional space is de Sitter, then you do still, in general, have some of these instabilities. That occurs in the case of Q equal 4. You can check that for higher than Q equal 4. What is your question?
Is that when you have lower dimensions, de Sitter, right?
Yeah.
I can write it down as an expanding universe, right?
Mm-hmm.
So rather than writing down it as a static solution, I can write it down as inflationary solution from lower dimensional perspective, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that correct?
To translate into more stream language, she's saying there are cases where, like our universe, where the compact directions are not really synchronized. The moduli become tachyon.
Yeah, but I'm saying, no, see, that's
you're asking about the time scale of the,
sorry?
You're asking about the time scale of the instability, whether it's,
well, that's one possibility. But the second one, I already have a dynamic, you know, when my vacuum is disabled, it's not a static. I don't think of it as a static solution.
So what you should ask is whether the stability, or whether the time scale for the instability is comparable to the sitter.
To maybe the Hubble scale.
Yes.
Hubble
scale.
Right. So that's
not true here, because the time scale for the instability here is the Kaluza Klein scale, which can be much less than Hubble's. So in that case,
can it be? Because this is, again, this is sort of going back to this condition, right? So the Hubble scale will be determined by, you know, by whatever charge you have. So is that really true that you're going to be in this regime when the Kaluza-Klein scale is going to be much less than the Hubble scale? Is that the case? Yes?
Yeah, I think it can be the case. Yeah.
Okay, so
I don't think I really understood the question. So you can write the large to sitter as either static or cosmological.
So I have already dynamics. Now the point here is that there is something that's unstable. It's like I'm sitting at the top, you know, m squared is less than zero. So that mode is going to be an inflaton. So from the effect, I guess at that stage, when you have a de Sitter as your vacuum solution, I'm not sure whether the static analysis, whether I would do static analysis, right?
I mean, if there's an instability, that's like saying you have the sitter, like you say, you have an unstable de Sitter whereas there's some shape mode that can be thought of as a field at the top of the potential and it's going to roll off. Isn't that right?
But so the time-dependent description is only a time-dependent description of the large dimensions, and they're only considering perturbations of the compact dimensions?
No, I like to think in terms of Kaluza-Klein dimensions. So then there is a scale. I like to think from this perspective. So there is a Hubble scale associated with the de Sitter vacuum, and then there is a Kaluza-Klein scale. And then there is a question of, at least naively, whether or not the Kaluza-Klein scale is important. I have to see if it is... If it would be much, much less than a Hubble scale, then negative, then, you know, then I would say I don't know, but it sounds like there should be an analogy to BF bound or something like that. I don't know. In the specific.
I think some instabilities in the sitter might not be that
hard
to translate.
That's I guess what I'm trying to say. That sometimes, you know, instability in the sitter, maybe I shouldn't worry about that. So my universe is expanding at a huge rate. So the fact that I have a growing mode maybe is not such a big deal anymore. And so then there should be some kind of criteria. The most naive criteria is, you know, the ratio of Kaluza-Klein scale to a Hubble scale. But again, I know that Lev Kaufman was thinking a long time ago.
But it's still a qualitatively different kind of thing than the BF band.
Yes, it is. Yes, of course it is. Yes, yes.
It's how bad your day is as opposed to this kills you.
Right, so should I move on? Or? Okay, so again, we're not comparing with the BF bound, we're looking at the actual sign of the mass squared, which is, as we'll see later, is what we care about. And as you start from lambda equals zero, and as you decrease the total cosmological constant, and especially as you increase the radius, then this pushes this pushes you out to develop more and more instabilities or negative mass squared in the higher L modes. And then conversely, as you increase lambda and push out to larger radius, more and more modes become stable. So this is the basic picture you should keep in mind. I'll also return to review some of these things later. Okay, so we have reviewed the symmetric solutions. Now let's move on to consider the warp solutions. So recall this is our starting action. And it turns out that there's actually a new set of lumpy warp solutions that can be found numerically for q larger than or equal to 3. So now the picture that you should have in mind is some lower dimensional space forming a warped product with some, in general, lumpy manifold. And now let's explore some of their physics. Okay, so the metric now we generalize to the following. Now, the radius of the sphere is no longer constant, but has some theta dependence, where theta is a coordinate on the sphere. And we have this non-trivial warp factor in front of the p-dimensional part.
Factors of proper spaces, but we're going to leave the internal symmetries of the spaces intact.
Yeah. They're warp factors. But yeah, the internal spaces.
So these are just, the warp factors. That is, so you have conformal factors, R and theta, and pi, in terms of each of those metrics. And each of those will still be Einstein spaces. D omega and ds will still be Einstein spaces.
Right. Yeah. Okay. And same ds, dsp. So our flux onset, similarly, it's no longer just proportional to the volume form. It has also this non-trivial warp factor. Okay, so to find these solutions, what we do is we use a numerical shooting technique. We start from the equator, and we vary q, which parameterizes the flux and the total cosmological constant. And when we impose regularity at the poles as well as evenness about the equator, and then we can use this technique to find the solutions. So the symmetry breaking pattern here is that the SOQ plus 1 symmetry of the Q sphere is broken to SOQ cross Z2. So notice that the Z2 part here just results from imposing evenness about the equator. So that is just for convenience, really. In general, there's a larger class of lumpy solutions which are lumpy in a way which does not respect evenness about the equator. But as a first attempt, we impose this extra symmetry. You could extend this to try to find the more lumpy solution, the other lumpy solution.
That's not the most generic.
It's not the most general.
As you're saying, like, d omega q is d omega q minus 1 warped with, some theta-dependent warp factor and stuff. Right, so the metric, so you're basically filling in one theta coordinate from the sphere.
Yeah.
And you allow the metric to depend on it. So, but you still impose, SOQ. But so the d omega q has more symmetries than it should in general, right? So there is additional field there. You see what I'm saying?
If you want to know about those, you can ask me about the metrics. Turns out something I'm working on. But
so okay, so you're saying there is a mode there, but that mode is massive.
No, there's a longer story that I don't want to get into, but I'm happy to do it. But she's just saying, let's take the simplest possible thing.
But it is not the full answer. See, there is one additional mode, so I'm saying it's not going to be a consistent.
This is her ansatz, and then her job is to demonstrate that it's consistent, and then she can solve. Right.
Yeah, it's just we're looking for some solutions. We make this onset, and then we show that they can be solutions. Sure, in general, you might find other solutions, but we're just starting from a very pedestrian viewpoint here.
And also, that's when you just won't find any solutions of that form.
Isn't the goal? The goal is to show that there are instabilities. So even if he doesn't find the most general instability,
that it's not that there are instabilities; it's that there are solutions. So So formerly, people studied the symmetric solutions. Let's move on from that and look for new classes of solutions. This may not be, there may be,
I understand. All I'm saying is that that d omega q squared I can write down as d theta squared plus sine squared theta times d omega q minus 1 squared. Now, because you basically broke the symmetry of the sphere, instead of sine squared theta, it can be, in some general function. So I have additional field which is morphing of the theta coordinate inside the omega cube. You are saying that there is a consistent solution when that warping is equal to precisely some sine theta. That's basically what you were saying. But there can be more solutions. Well, I guess I'll see what.
We're just picking an onsets and showing that it's a solution.
Instead of the most symmetric solution, they're looking for the maximum symmetric.
This is the generic onsets with this symmetry.
No, that's what I object. There is additional, because, okay, so what I'm saying is that how do you write down the metric on the three sphere, right? So it's d theta squared plus sine squared theta times ds2. Okay, so I can still preserve the symmetries that are being preserved as a symmetry sort of omega q minus 1.
Yeah.
But then there is a theta coordinate. And so omega q minus 1 and the theta coordinate would make it into omega q. That's what she still insists on preserving. But I'm saying that
by redefining that theta coordinate, can't you?
No, you can't. It's
only modes, not closed.
It is an additional mode. It's, if you wish, it's an additional warp factor or additional breezing. Well, it's not a breeze, it's a squashing mode inside this cube. And so if you say that those are the symmetries, then she has to include that mode as well.
So what if you don't commit to the periodicity of theta?
Well, I mean, you don't know. I mean, you have to allow, you say now your symmetries are SOQ, and so subject to that symmetries, there is an additional field that is missing in this answer. And it is possible, and there are examples where you can find solution in this, additional, what I would call inconsistent truncation. But those solutions, but then you might end up making a wrong physical claim based on that, simply because you nailed that the fields that can be dynamical, you nailed it to be zero. Okay.
That means you just might not find the most general.
That's right. And so that's what I'm saying. I'm going to wait until whatever conclusion she says, because the conclusions can depend on whether or not you allow that field to be excited.
Now, just to be clear, theta is going to be a polar, not a periodic angle. Is that correct?
It's just the polar angle.
Okay,
so we'll proceed with this onsets and study solution. So you start using this technique, and you actually generate a proliferation of possible solutions. And let's just take the approach of looking at some of these solutions and then trying to narrow down some of the physics. So there's many possible solutions, which it turns out you can kind of think is classified by the number of extremum of these solutions. So there's the zero extremum case, which is just the symmetric solution. There's solutions with one extremum, and here in this column I've just plotted what the shape looks like using embedding coordinates. These one extremum solutions, either it's a football shape or an M&M shape, and then in general there are what we call the higher L solutions, which have more extremum, and so here I've shown one which looks sort of like a diamond shape. So our game plan here is to consider the number of extrema as a classifier. So for simplicity, we're going to start by restricting to the one extremum solutions. Then to study these solutions, we use numerical techniques to map out their phase space. And later, we can return to motivate this picture using an effective potential description. So let me start by parametrizing the solutions using a convenient and physical order parameter, which is the ellipticity. So we just defined the ellipticity as follows in terms of the distance between the poles and over the distance around the equator. And so for these one extremum solutions, here are the three possibilities. And there's the sphere, there's the M&M shape, which has epsilon less than 1, and there's the football shape, which has epsilon larger than 1. Okay, so we use numerical techniques to map out the phase space, and this is a cartoon picture of what we find. So we find that as when n is very small, there's a second set of solutions which are M&M shaped. And as we increase n, they become closer and closer to the spherical shape until a certain point, a certain critical value of n where they become exactly spherical, cross over, and then become football shaped above that n. And then there's another critical value of n beyond which there are no possible solutions.
My comment can make a huge difference. So the reason when you're going along some branch and you're finding that within Yuan's arcs the solution disappears, precisely at that time you can find or extend that branch by allowing the fields that you set to zero inside this field.
Well, this is exactly analogous. This is just disappearing of the branch is exactly analogous to what we discussed in just the symmetric ansatz case. It's the case where the two solutions, the unstable max and the stable minimum, come together, merge, and annihilate.
Did you do stability analysis in this solution?
In the warp solutions? Not yet. That's one of the things I'll talk about in future work.
Okay. So
they disappear at exactly that same critical value of n.
So the mode that I have in mind is precisely the mode that you should be checking.
Can I go back? I'm still confused. So I thought the ansatz she wrote down was analogous to saying that the spherical solution is like a of r dr squared plus b of r d sub n minus 1 omega.
I still don't understand why it's not.
She's saying the exact analog. The theta coordinate is not a coordinate inside the spherical, instead the p-dimensional sphere method.
Sorry, then I misunderstood.
I think it is. I thought it was.
Theta is a coordinate in the sphere.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's in the lower dimensional sphere.
It's only in the higher dimensional sphere.
That's what I said. That's the way I understood. So she misses one extra field.
When you say that the most general spherically symmetric static solution looks like this.
Can anybody read that?
What?
The glare is making that hard to read.
The most general spherically symmetric
SOP plus 1. That's SOP plus 1 symmetry, right? Now she has now she wants to write a solution which has SOP symmetry, which is less.
And you mean Q, right?
Well, I don't know. He calls it P and she calls it Q. So you guys have to decide what you call this here.
Oh.
P or Q. Okay. Doesn't matter. Once you break the symmetry, typically there are additional fields associated with breaking the symmetry.
Okay, sorry. The extra dimensional space, we used to be considering it a sphere, a Q sphere.
Yes. So right.
Now we're only gonna take Q minus 1 symmetry on these slices.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
So we can have arbitrary dependence on this angle thing.
That's right. So the additional field I'm saying is the radius of the Q minus 1 sphere. That's an additional field.
That's theta though. Mm-hmm.
That's right, but if you write down the metric as a round Q sphere, you nail that field to be precisely equal sine theta. And I'm saying that there is no reason for it to be equal to
sine theta. Theta is not a coordinate on this sphere.
No, it's this coordinate.
It's where it ends up. So said it another way. So you're writing it as d theta squared plus sine squared times that. And what Alex is saying, and I agree with him on a global basis, is in general there's another function of theta times the sine squared there. Locally that can be absorbed, but it can't be absorbed globally.
Right, but that's if you just allow for arbitrary periodicity of theta, then there's only one arbitrary function there.
Only locally, if it's in particular, you have a periodic condition, and then if it's oscillatory, you definitely can't do that.
But you'll see that as a failure of the periodicity or something.
This has nothing. Einstein equations are local equations. I don't have to talk about it. You impose local symmetry, which is SOQ in this case. There is additional field solution. You can argue then that field can be massive, and so that mode is not excited.
I know that mode is pure gauge, though.
It's not pure gauge. No, it's not pure gauge. It is excited. It's okay. So usually, what happens is that there is a high-dimensional space, and you can have some compact circles, right? So then it's a fiber space. There is a base, and there is a U1 fiber inside. So it's not. If it would be a circle, then I would say you have just a circle fiber over some base. So you have a manifold where you know the size of this vibration is fixed. Okay. But now I am saying that once you break the symmetry, the size of the vibration can change. It can be, and that's your additional view.
Yes.
And I know high dimensional examples where that is exactly what happens and what must happen. And so this answer, strictly speaking, is inconsistent answer if you say that you have SOQ symmetry. That's all I'm saying.
Or just say, slightly less provocatively, it's not the most general ansatz. It doesn't mean it's inconsistent.
And I agree. Yes, I agree. Yes, I agree.
It's
less
provocative. Write it as d theta squared plus some sine squared times d omega q minus 1. And then maybe we should continue this discussion. Let's just adopt the viewpoint that I am picking some metric, and I can show that it's an additional set of provides an additional set of solutions to the Friend-Ribbon equations. Okay, so in terms of studying these solutions, I sort of talked about the shape. Now I want to talk about the value of lambda effective. It turns out that exactly before this critical point, where the solutions cross over from M&M to football shape, that is an exact correspondence, or that is exactly the case when these warp solutions have lower value of lambda effective. So they're dominant solutions. Similarly, once you cross N critical, they have higher values of lambda effective, so they're exactly subdominant solutions. And I have on this plot, this is represented in terms of the arrows, which point towards direction of decreasing lambda effective. So here below N critical, you have the symmetric solution, and generically it would want to go to the lumpy solution. Above N critical, it's the other way around. The lumpy solution would in general evolve towards the spherical solution. This is the case Q greater than or equal to 4 and lambda positive. So now let's look at some more general cases. Here, this is the exact numerical data, and many of the different cases that you can consider split into q equals 3 and q larger than or equal to 4, which have qualitatively different behavior. So first of all, there's some scaling properties of the equations of motion to keep in mind. The first is that this lambda has a rescaling combined with some rescaling of r and phi. And what this means is that it suffices to restrict to the cases lambda positive, lambda zero, and lambda negative. And within each of these cases, this rescaling symmetry just means that the solutions are equivalent. Also, in the special case lambda equals zero, there is this additional rescaling, which rescales the flux. So what this means is that for lambda equals zero, there's really only one solution. All of the solutions you find are mapped together by this rescaling, and that's related to the fact of why the lambda equals zero lines are just horizontal lines. There's a single solution there. So one thing that the last thing I want you to notice here is that these branches of these solutions, they merge together in the n goes to zero limit. Okay, so we're going to return to look at this again, but I just want to point out that you might notice that there are some intriguing similarities between some of the stability analysis that we discussed earlier. So let's recall some of the facts we learned. So here's our favorite plot again. In the same way that we restricted to one extremum solutions, let's restrict to L equals 2 modes. Let's consider first the case q equals 3. So when q equals 3, this second vertical line is the one that we're considering. And you notice that this is exactly marginally stable when lambda equals 0. And when lambda is negative, then this mode develops negative mass squared. And when lambda is positive, it develops positive mass squared. So let's look back at the plot here. This was the Q equals 3 case. Lambda equals 0 exactly coincided with the symmetric case. And then when lambda was positive, the solutions were always football-shaped, and they were always subdominant. And when lambda was less than 0, they're always M&M-shaped, and they're dominant. So I should just mention that in this plot, I haven't drawn the arrows, but you should just keep in mind that everything above epsilon equals 1 is subdominant, and everything below epsilon 1 is dominant. So let's next move on to the case of Q larger than or equal to 4. So in this case, we're looking at the L equals 2 mode for Q equals 4 is this line. And when lambda equals 0, this mode has a negative mass squared. And the same is true for negative lambda. When lambda is positive, it can sometimes have a negative mass squared and sometimes have a positive mass squared. OK, so let's look at this diagram again. So lambda equals 0, it could have a negative mass squared, and it is the solution which is M&M shaped and subdominant, which is true the same for lambda equals 0. When lambda is positive, it can sometimes be a dominant M&M shape, and it can sometimes be a subdominant football shaped. OK, so maybe you notice a pattern emerging. So this is what the pattern is. It turns out that when the L equals 2 danger mode has a negative mass squared, the ellipsoidal solution is M&M shaped and energetically favored. When the mode has a positive mass squared, the ellipsoidal solution is football shaped and energetically disfavored. There's also the fact, as I mentioned, that the n goes to 0 behavior is independent of lambda. So actually, if you remember from the stability plot, this was also true of the stability analysis. You take the n goes to 0 limit, which corresponds to looking in this region, and the stability properties all in this limit coincide with the lambda equals 0 case. And then finally, each Freund-Rubin solution is accompanied by a single ellipsoidal solution with the same value of this flux n. This characterizes these solutions.
Just
in terms of lower values of the potential.
Lower values of the.
Like lower lambda effective.
Okay.
Okay. So the pattern we see here is that the one extremum solutions are in one-to-one correspondence with the L equals 2 instability of the symmetric solution. You can ask if that story continues on for higher L. While we haven't exhaustively studied all higher L up to L equals infinity, we considered some cases. So here's a plot of what some of the solutions you find for the L equals 4 case. And you see the same exact pattern. So there is here, there's this diamond-shaped solution, which is subdominant, it has higher values of lambda effective. And as you increase n, there's a critical value of n where it passes through the symmetric solution. And then above that point, it becomes exactly box-shaped and always dominant, lower values of lambda effective. So the same principles seem to hold here. And we have a conjecture that we propose, which says that the L minus 1 extremum solution is in one-to-one correspondence with the L mode instability of the symmetric solution. Yes?
So those papers you cited earlier, I can't remember who, didn't they make a similar conjecture that the endpoints of the instability of the ellipsoidal solutions?
You're kind of getting ahead of the game here, but you mean you're talking about the papers by Kinoshita? Yeah. So they started the game by studying some of these solutions. We extended this. We mapped out in much more cases and much and more generally more of these solutions. And we're actually, so they propose that maybe these solutions are endpoints of the instability, but we want to study that in more detail and actually argue that they are.
Yeah. So you're giving kind of proof to what they were also.
Well, yeah, I mean, proof in the sense that we have an effective potential description, which I'll describe a little bit later, in which these solutions would be endpoints. Okay, so let's move on to this effective potential description. Okay, so now that we've mapped out the phase space of some of these warp solutions, we're going to argue for a nice effective potential picture that encapsulates the physics much in the way that the zero mode effective potential I described earlier encapsulated a lot of the physics of the symmetric solutions. So recall that towards the beginning of the talk, I drew this example of a potential. And this was where I'm freezing out the shape modes and I'm just allowing the volume to vary. So I'm looking in the direction of the radion. So there's another possible effective potential picture we could consider, which is where we move in the perpendicular direction. So here for the L equals 2 modes, this direction would be parameterized by a field, the ellipticity field. Okay, so when you look in this perpendicular direction, I want to try to motivate what the effective potential looks like in this direction. So imagine for the moment that you have a potential that close to sphericality looks cubic. So this is an example. Then in this case, as you increase n through some critical value, we know that the stability of the spherical solution changes. So we have n less than n critical, the spherical solution is unstable, and as we cross through that point, it becomes stable. So what happens when we cross through this point is that there's a phase transition. And if we additionally impose fixed asymptotics, this means that there are new solutions ejected. So what do I mean by this? In this case, I have this solution, the M&M-shaped solution. As I pass through the critical value in order to flip the mass squared sign around spherical, that solution lifts away, and a new solution is generated in the football region. In this case, it's an unstable solution.
You're finding the effective via the value of the effective Causal constant in the large dimension, saying you have numerically generated dots along each of those curves?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. But this is a schema. This is just an argument. We did not derive the effective potential. Like, we did not compute it, except for in a particular limit. Okay, we didn't compute it generally. But we have physical arguments to motivate its shape. Okay, so actually, you'll notice that this simple possibility for what the effective potential picture is actually very consistent with what we sketched out for the phase diagram, because here we have always one solution for every spherical solution at a fixed value of n, and at a certain point it crosses over from M&M-shaped and stable, or M&M-shaped and dominant, to football-shaped and subdominant, and I'll return and discuss the connections a little more in detail. So having a different shape for the effective potential would really change the phase space. So one example you could consider is, imagine that the potential did not look cubic around this point, but looked quadratic. Then in this case, if you have to flip the sign of the mass squared past some critical value of n, then you actually would generate, spit out two new solutions at this point, both of which would be stable. So the phase space for this possibility for the effective potential would have been very different. We would have spit out, there would be a critical value of n, and at this critical value of n, there would have appeared two different branches of solutions which would merge and cross through with the symmetric solution. Okay, so we also want to ask what the asymptotics of this potential might be. There are a few possibilities. One is, if in extension of the plot that I drew earlier, we could extend the potential to plus infinity in the M&M direction and minus infinity in the football direction. Another possibility is it could turn around in either or both directions. And then a third possibility is it could have a finite asymptote in both directions. So the second possibility, while we haven't proved that it's not the case, it seems likely that this is not true, just in the sense that we exhaustively scanned over the whole parameter space looking for solutions, and we really only found one for each Freund-Rubin solution. So if this were the case, we should have found more evidence of more solutions. As far as the finite asymptote goes, this would require a long flat section of the effective potential with no symmetry to protect it, which we find unlikely. So we're led to consider the first possibility. And furthermore, there's kind of an intuitive argument for why you might expect this to be true, which is that imagine this picture of the football shape with the flux distributed on the poles. Well, we know that the flux wants to repel itself, so the poles are going to want to push out, and the flux is going to want to concentrate on the poles. And the more that it does that, the more it leaves the equatorial circle unbuttressed. And then when there's no flux to buttress the circle, it naturally wants to collapse from the curvature term. So there's a runaway effect where the poles want to push away, and the equatorial circle wants to collapse. And so there's an instability, which in this case would be to the minus infinity direct football shape direction. So I couldn't draw it pinching off infinitely, so I'm cutting it off at the point where the effective theory no longer holds. Okay, so a summary of this, because this is very important, I think it's useful to make sure we're on the same page here, is that there's a consistent effective potential description, which I've given, which is a very simple picture, which is exactly consistent with all the physics of our phase diagram. So the picture is as follows. We have an effective potential in the shape direction that looks like these two plots that I've already shown you. And for the region when n is less than this critical value of n, we're in the region where the symmetric solution is unstable, and we have additionally a lumpy solution at lower values of the effective that's dominant. As we increase n, they come closer and closer together, and then they cross over. And past this point, the symmetric solution is now stable, but the lumpy solution switches to being a football shaped on this side of the plot at higher value of the effective, and it is subdominant. Okay, so just again to reiterate, the nice thing about this picture is that the classical stability of the symmetric solution exactly determines the form of the lumpy solution, its shape, its stability, and whether it's dominant or subdominant. Okay, so I'm just going to end by sketching out, just pointing out some things about non-perturbative decays. So once you believe this form of the effective potential, this leads to the possibility of new non-perturbative decays. So one dramatic possibility is a new non-perturbative instability where even in the case when the spherical solution is stable, you want to tunnel to the infinite football-shaped direction. And similarly, even when the symmetric solution is stable, you can tunnel to the M&M stable solutions. So you can do an estimate, and because typical mass squareds in the shape direction are a couple orders of magnitude smaller than in the total volume direction, also you can do a slightly more precise estimate using a Hawking-Moss instanton, you find that the shape mode tunneling is actually the fastest decay, faster than any other decay studied in this model. For example, decompactification, which is where you tunnel out in the zero mode potential out to infinite radius. So we did some estimates for this special case, p equals q equals 4 and lambda is positive, which is actually it's a special case for some reasons if you want to consider de Sitter in your lower dimensional space. And we found that, well, to begin with, 97% of the Freund-Rubin vacua are perturbatively unstable. And but even out of those 3% that are perturbatively stable, there's actually 2.97% that decay to footballs. So the conclusion here is that really the Freund-Rubin branch is just obliterated. There's an overwhelming tendency for these solutions to want to become lumpy. Okay, so I'm kind of out of time, so I'm just going to really quickly discuss some future work. So one possibility, in the form of our ansatz, we sort of picked an alignment for this symmetry breaking. But in general, you could imagine a symmetry breaking which occurs along different axes at different points in space-time. And you can ask about whether this might lead to topologically non-trivial configurations. I think that's an interesting thing to look at. Also, it would be very interesting to study the evolution in the shape direction potential further from spherically. Essentially, just try to learn more about this effective potential, which is a hard question, but I think is very interesting. We want to generalize this very simple flux compactification to some more realistic models. And finally, it's interesting that for these warp solutions, it's not actually the full stability calculation, analogous to the three papers I referred to for the direct product calculation. This has not been done in general. So it would be very interesting to just repeat the Kaluza-Klein stability analysis for warp product solutions. Again, a problem that could have been studied 50 years ago, but which is open. Okay, so my conclusions is that there exist additional lumpy solutions to the Freund-Rubin equations that can be more stable than the symmetric branch. There's a symmetry breaking effect where the internal sphere generically rolls to these new solutions. And even when the symmetric solution is stable, we found new non-perturbative decays to lumpiness, including to the infinite football shape direction. These are the fastest yet known decays for this model. We derived a phase diagram and argued that all physics is neatly encapsulated by a shape direction effective potential. Okay. All right, thank you for listening.
Have you thought about the dynamics of these models? So if you had, for example, a dynamical background and like the other instabilities like parametric resonance, and then like similarly in a dynamical situation, you know, instabilities can be your friend, like, you know, the Jeans instability is the reason that we're all here right now. So like instabilities don't have to be bad things, and you know, they can be.
I never said that it was a bad thing, I think that this is the extent of what we study so far, but you're right that it would be very interesting to study a more general case like dynamics within this effective potential.
Dynamical solutions without putting in a scalar potential, or do you have to have a scalar potential for that?
Just if you have the radion like evolving from small radius to large radius and oscillating about its minimum, then the oscillations of the radion could come some kind of parametric resonance.
You don't have to put in any more ingredients?
He's just saying start it in some place where it's not a static solution and let it evolve however it evolves.
Oh yeah, I mean, I don't know, you could probably call the matter on the same.
Yeah, interesting question to study, yeah.
So, two things. Mm-hmm. So when you say you've got a non-perturbative instability, the evidence for this is you have this effective potential with a more negative region, you haven't done any ins and cons or anything.
We did an estimate of using a Hawking Moss instanton, but you could. There's certainly a lot more to be studied in making that precise.
And also to see if I understood this right, these are all instabilities for flat or center spaces, not for anything center spaces. Yes.
What is the question?
So are there? Do you claim there are any of these instabilities for anti-de-Sitter space or only for flat and the center?
For anti-de Sitter space, you have to compare with the BF bound.
Sorry.
So in that case, I think there can be instabilities. I mean, you should look at our paper, the one that we wrote with Kurt. We have a nice summary of like exactly the parameter space when there are instabilities for all the different choices of the parameters. But in that case, you do have to compare with the BF bound. So at the top of my head, it's a little different.
I kind of remember all about the wolf, and when they wrote the paper a long time ago, I thought that the instabilities arise, but somehow in some ridiculous dimension. So it's not that.
Yeah, it's Q bigger than 9 or something.
Yeah, or something like that. So there are constraints, there are this type of constraints. So.
I was trying to see if they were making the same kind of thing or not.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that here, what mattered was whether that mass squared was positive or negative in terms of determining the lumpy solution. But what I'm saying is that it's not the stability that's important for determining the lumpy solutions in the ADS case. It's the sign of the mass squared term. It's
Do you claim that in the anti-de Sitter case as well?
sorry, so that chart that I showed you whether the mass squared sine is positive or negative. So in the de Sitter and the flat case, that's the same as asking about stability. In the ADS case, it's different. You have to compare with the BF bound. When I say that the sine of the mass squared determines the properties of these lumpy solutions, I'm really referring to the sine of the mass squared. I'm not referring, in the case of ADS, that's not the same thing as the stability analysis. That's all I'm trying to say.
I guess implicitly he was asking the question whether ADS can get lumpy.
Yeah.
Or at least that was their connection.
And it looks like it.
Well, so it's at least, yeah, so the moral of this is that yes. Like, I mean, so either you, for the exact parameter space of what the exact parameter of the space of the perturbative instabilities I'd have to look up in that paper, I don't have off the top of my head, but the moral of this story is that whether you're talking about, in general, even if you don't have a perturbative instability, you're gonna have these solutions sitting at that are dominant that you're gonna tunnel to. So I would say that the answer to that is that yes, they'll generically want to become lumpy.
But these solutions, these are funny solutions that you look at perturbative instabilities. You have to study stabilities of those solutions.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, that's why I mentioned that as an open, interesting question. It's true in the case, in a certain sense, you can think of like the physical origin for these, the tend towards lumpiness is that, you know, there's clumping of energy density. It's exactly analogous to like the Jeans instability or like the Gregory-Laflamme instability, where the flux wants to clump. And so you can imagine that it's not just going to be satisfied, even it's not just going to be satisfied becoming a little clumpy. It might roll to one of these solutions, but then there's going to be other instabilities to even more lumpy solutions, and it's just going to become lumpier and lumpier if you believe the physical intuition for why these things occur. So I agree that it's very interesting next to study these lumpy solutions, and I would suspect that there's a similar picture of lumpy solutions evolving to more lumpy solutions.
Is it tunneling rate? Is it finite? The tunneling, so you're saying that there can be tunneling.
You can compute what the rate is.
Mm-hmm. And the space is compact. I mean, the lower dimensional, if it is in non-compact, then...
So the internal space is compact.
The internal one, but the lower dimensional space. Oh, sorry.
The lower dimensional space is just like a de Sitter.
You're saying, but wouldn't you... I saw that the tunneling, if the... Right, so I have a non-compact space, right, and then I have that one. And,
no, if the thing that she's changing were not compact, that would be worrying. If it's compact, like usual stuff.
Or just comparing the Euclidean action between the two solutions.
So according to the exact potential, the same is that when the MM shift is stable, it also comes to the end,
we're
always just...
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, the football, it has a minus infinity direction, so you can tunnel to... There's this instability which causes this... I mean, and it would be interesting to also see, like, for example, from the lower dimensional perspective, what happens as you roll off in that direction of the effective potential. You know, there's a certain point when our effective theory is going to break down, because in these directions, they're sort of like... they're volume conserving. So as the football expands, the equatorial part pinches off, and at a certain point, it becomes so small that our effective description breaks down. So things will tunnel to infinite football direction, and at a certain point, the effective theory breaks down. So another interesting question is what really happens in this instability?
Well, it depends on the
tunnel.
Well, I mean, what happens? What happens, for example, from the 4D perspective, or as you're getting to the point when the theory breaks down?
If we're talking about like a small amount, you claim it's the same.
Yeah, but the formula is big.
If you can shoot the tunnel rate,
yeah, so I'm.
So you claim it's like stable from cosmology.
Yeah.
And actually, it can survive long enough that you never really observe.
Yeah, so you could try computing the exact tunneling rate from the M&M shape, but given the form of the potential, there's a possibility for it to decay.
times.
Okay.
So thanks a lot. So again, we'll have dinner at 6:30 if anyone wants to join.